Blog Talk Radio.
It does it.
Thursday, July the 10th, 10 p.m. TerraCheck.
Final frontier.
There is nothing wrong with your computer. Do not attempt to adjust the sound. We are controlling transmission. For the next hour, sit back and we shall control all that you hear. There is nothing wrong with your computer system. You are about to participate in a great adventure. You are about to experience the awe and mystery which reaches from the inner mind and into TerraCheck.
This is TerraCheck.
Your connection has been established.
Communication frequencies are now open.
Ladies and gentlemen, your host, Colin Knight.
Coming to the top of the hour, we welcome our TerraChat listeners on blogtalkradio.com, also our friends at skype.com, UK Blitz, Kangaroo Cafe in Sydney, Australia, and of course, our good friends from the Department of Homeland Security, the NSA, CIA, CSIS, etc. ad infinitum. It's 10 p.m. Eastern. Do you know where your politicians are? Welcome to International Terror Chat, thinking outside of the box.
You're in the night zone with the Calling Knight as we look up at the heavens in search of divine wisdom, which will lead us to our rightful home. We search as a caveman would forage for food. 2012, the second coming. Nibiru, the Anunnaki, Planet X, the end of time.
Yeah, I'm still beating the drum for the Planet X, the Nibiru, and the Anunnaki. Join us July the 19th when Tim McHyde will be joining us, and Tim will be giving us a special look at the possibilities of 2012 and the end times, but we'll be looking at it from a Christian perspective, from the prophecies of the Bible. We all have busy lives and can't always be at the computer catching TerraChat live. Thanks to blogtalkradio.com for making TerraChat archive accessible. Come to TerraChat on blogtalkradio.com and check out our show files.
BlogTalkRadio.com.
Dr. Ian O'Neill is back with us tonight. Ian joined us for the 2012 show, and we got into so much conversation we actually ran out of time. So Ian is back with us tonight. He's the founder and editor of AstroEngine.com. If you get a chance, check that out. AstroEngine.com.
Wanting to speak live to our guest, Dr. Ian O'Neill? Have a question you need answered? Call in 347-324-3287. For those of you in our virtual studio, talk to host. And now, your host, Colin Knight, and his special guest, Dr. Ian O'Neill.
And a ticket to the moon. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, madam, messieurs. Welcome to TerraChat. This is the Night Zone, and we have back with us tonight Dr. Ian O'Neill. He is the founder of AstroEngine.com. Good evening, Ian. I believe you're in California tonight.
Yes, I am, Colin. Thank you for inviting me back.
Oh, it's absolutely a pleasure, sir. I don't think we had hardly enough time the last time. It flew by. I don't know about you, but I lost track of time. Thank goodness I have a counter that slaps me in the face every so often to tell me to take a break. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, Ian, looking at what's been going on since your last visit and with the Mars Phoenix finally sniffing out the building blocks of life, and all of these UFO encounters in England, what's your take on the learning curve that we seem to be going through right now?
Well, I've been following the Phoenix mission intently since it landed. I've been lucky enough because, of course, I'm writing for the Universe Today still, and I've pretty much exhausted all possible story avenues on Phoenix. So I just find it so captivating. But yeah, of course, as you say, the most recent discovery is the fact that Mars soil is very much like terrestrial soil up in the Arctic tundra and places like that. It's got very similar pH levels, so the acidity is very, very similar. And I've always had an issue with calling the stuff that's on the surface of Mars soil, because soil to me is something with organic stuff in it that we can grow plants in. And so many, you know, writers always talked about, you know, the Mars soil and how we can be used in the future by Mars settlers. And I've always thought that it's incorrect to call it soil, because at the end of the day, it's not soil. It's regolith. It's actually the stuff. It's just very, very small pieces of rock. Of course, these words are kind of unfounded now, because the Phoenix lander has actually characterized the Martian regolith as being very, very similar to terrestrial soil. So my views have changed radically. So suddenly, many of the characteristics that I thought the Mars soil didn't have, it can actually be called Mars soil now because of this robotic mission that's on the surface of Mars. So our learning curve about Mars now has gone through the roof, and I'm just so impressed by this mission, because, to be honest, I thought the odds were stacked against it. But, you know, it's really pulling out all the stops, and I'm very, very impressed with it.
Well, the idea that you could send a robotic machine as far away as you can and manipulate it to take scientific samples and qualify those samples and send the information back to Earth, I mean, that's outstanding.
It's incredible. And the best thing for me was the first image to come from the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, which was already orbiting Mars. And it was watching the Phoenix lander re-enter the atmosphere and open its parachute. And there's a fantastic image that, you know, NASA put on their website and also on the Phoenix mission site, where you saw this huge Mars crater and you had a little parachute with the Phoenix lander coming through the atmosphere. And that's what struck me, was we've got a robot looking after another robot that's re-entering a planet which is, what, minimum 6 months fly time from here. I just found that incredible. That, for me, was the moment that really got me very, very interested in that mission.
So do you think that now that they have they've qualified that that there is of use going to Mars, do you think we're going to see a manned mission sooner than later?
It depends. I've also run some articles, fairly disheartening articles, about the current politics around NASA, the European Space Agency, and the drive by other nations to get into space. I mean, some space agencies are politically driven, other ones are more scientifically driven. But to actually make it to another planet, to get a return mission, first of all, to the moon, NASA's hoping to get back there by 2020. Well, there's no guarantee that we're going to get back for 2020. Although I suspect it's going to be a lot later, depending on who's going to be voted into office next term. So our attention is now focusing on perhaps the European Space Agency, because they are really, you know, pushing for more of a manned emphasis on their missions, which would be incredible. And of course, don't discount the Russians. I mean, admittedly, they are vastly underfunded, but they've got big aspirations. It could happen to go to Mars in the next 50 years, and we've got the technology to pretty much do it now. If we had a concerted effort, I mean, just look what happened with the Apollo missions. Within 5 years, we had a viable manned mission to the moon, and it just took a lot of funding and a lot of political direction. So
a commitment from the White House and down the line. That I think
Absolutely.
That all was all set up because the JFK, we will send a man to the moon.
Yeah.
He kicked it off. Here's an interesting political twist to this. Who do you think is more receptive to space travel? Would it be Republicans or Democrats?
I'm not totally certain. I've read some articles that Obama is more into homeland funding, so he wants to redirect some NASA funding into education and medical programs. I'm not totally certain of the details of that. Republican side, there seems to be a lot of emphasis on the Iraq situation at the moment, and there may need to be an increase in funding there. There's not an awful lot of talk about massive funding. I'd like to think, you know, Democrats and Republicans will realize the importance of space, because it draws in massive amounts of funding. It builds jobs, it builds economies. And it's just a shame that when you're looking at the decommissioning of the shuttle, that there's going to be a five-year gap between the shuttle and the next NASA space return mission, which is the Constellation program. I mean, what's going to happen in those 5 years? These politicians need to realize that five-year gap is going to be extremely costly, not only to the United States, but also to the rest of the world, because NASA spearheads most of our efforts in space at the moment. And it does risk being taken over by some other nations. Look at China. They're going to be sending a man on his first EVA at the end of this year. He's hoping, hoping to send a man into space to start exploring space. And they want to send a return mission. Well, they want to send their own mission to the moon in 10 years. I mean, that's what they're saying.
And they have the funding. If they the government decides it will happen, regardless of whether it's financially feasible or not, it will happen.
Yeah, sure.
I do agree. We need to keep the curve. We need to stay ahead of the curve. However, does it make a difference, I wonder, whether China gets there first or whether we do, and what value is it to us in that respect? We automatically look at military and strategic value on everything that we do for some reason.
I mean, you and me were both, we used to be British. And, coming from the UK, we haven't had a manned space program, and Margaret Thatcher in the 80s pretty much cancelled our involvement in any manned space program, leaving it to Europe and NASA to do all those things. She had her reasons, that's fair enough. But I've always looked to NASA as the guiding light as far as space travel is concerned, and of course, Britain's always been closely allied to the US, so there's always been close cooperation. And I don't really mind the fact that China may do it first. It's going to be politically driven, we know that, and perhaps even Japan may get a move on in space. They're certainly sending an awful lot into space at the moment. Yeah. And there's also a lot of private funding. We can't discount the American companies like SpaceX. They're sending a lot of stuff into space, and they're hoping to bridge this five-year gap between Shuttle and Constellation. But I still would love to think that NASA can be a viable entity in the future, because there's such a vast amount of expertise there. It'd be a shame to lose out.
And I think also that NASA is the world standard, if you will. They have standardized a lot of the medical issues regarding space travel and space flight, and the restrictions and and all of that. These UFOs in England. How did Britain play out at the time that the story was breaking in North America? We got stories over here of globes chasing helicopters and dive bombing and all kinds of fancy, funky, paranormal, extraterrestrial action. How did it play out in England?
It was interesting because my hometown is Bristol, which is in the southwest of the country, and that's very close to Wiltshire, which is where all the crop circles tend to appear. And around that time, there was several stories coming out about these new crop circles. And at exactly the same time, we had all these reports about UFOs, and apparently some RAF fighter jets were scrambled. We don't really hear of that. I mean, in the southwest of the UK, it's fairly sleepy. We don't usually we got some military bases there, we got a lot of military testing, but we don't really have, aircraft being scrambled to chase off UFOs. And apparently, it was actually a couple of weeks ago, there was a report on the local news. And the problem is with a lot of the local news, Peter, they take light of what's actually going on. They put the spooky music on there, the X-Files and all this. And it kind of puts it in a light-hearted vein. It's not taken seriously, which is fine. I mean, at the end of the day, it's a source of entertainment. But it doesn't really help when you're actually asking these questions. What are they? There was no question about what these things were. It was just basically a bunch of nuts that had a few to drink, and they started seeing these bright lights. But these were credible people. We had Air Force pilots who actually saw these things. They spent a lot of time in the air. They've seen pretty much everything. And one of these sightings was very intriguing in that it was a silver orb. It is one of the rare sunny days that we had over the summer. And he was watching this orb, and sure enough, a jet flew over it, and it moved out of the way, and then darted off in the other direction. Then this jet sort of followed it along, and then it disappeared. And there was reports coming from the military that they did see an unidentified object, but they didn't know what it was. And that was pretty much it. There was really no follow-up, especially on the media. And I kind of did some digging, of course, and I came across these crop circle events that had happened in Wilshire. And I actually ran an article on astroengine.com, and it turned out to be my most read article I've ever done. within a week, I think it hit 60,000 in such a short space of time. But that was a record for AstroEngine. So obviously people want to know.
Yeah, really. It's one of those fascinating things. I know I got the story from Chris Holly over on Endless Journey blog. And she kind of turned me onto the story, and I started digging into it, and it's like, oh my goodness, like, mm-hmm. This is pretty credible. And we're not talking about, Joe Hayseed in the backfields of Shropshire, you know. Mm-hmm. These guys have been around the block. Ian, sure. We're coming up to a soft break here, so we're going to give the people a break. When we come back, I'm interested in asking you about solar weather. This one fascinates me, but we'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Dr. Ian O'Neill. Join us July the 19th when Tim McHyde will be joining us. And Tim will be giving us a special look at the possibilities of 2012 at the end times. But we'll be looking at it from a Christian perspective, from the prophecies of the Bible. We all have busy lives and can't always be at the computer catching TerraChat live. Thanks to blogtalkradio.com for making TerraChat archive accessible. Come to TerraChat on blogtalkradio.com and check out our show files. blogtalkradio.com.
Wanting to speak live to our guests? Dr. Ian O'Neill. Have a question you need answered? Call in 347-324-3287. 347-324-3287. For those of you in our virtual studio, talk to host. And now, your host, Colin Knight, and his special guest, Dr. Ian O'Neill.
And we are back with Dr. Ian O'Neill. For the benefit of our new listeners, let me just do a quick recap of who and what Ian O'Neill is all about, because any person can step up to the plate, but those with the credentials are the ones that we like to listen to. Ian is a solar physicist, founder and editor of the AstroEngine.com. His blog topics cover areas like quantum mechanics, solar physics, relativity, cosmology, spaceflight, and science. And some of the more bizarre theories that drive our universe, Ian writes of Nostradamus and the Mayan prophecies, especially the doomsday events, according to Mayan calendar decodings and Planet X, but all from a scientific viewpoint. Ian is a British doctor of solar physics with nearly a decade of physics study and research experience from Aberystwyth, a PhD from the University of Wales. And it goes on and on and on, Ian, and I won't embarrass you with just continuing with the accolades, but I got to say the Mars Foundation, Marspedia, AstroEngine, University Today, I think I may have missed a couple in England too, come to think about it, but you're a busy man.
Yeah, well, I've kind of been, a way of trying to fund my PhD was to do some web designing, and I kind of self-taught how to do my own websites, and I kind of went a bit freelance with web design. I mean, it was really strange because I'm not really much of a programmer, or so I thought, but then I kind of got involved in web design, and I just combined my two hobbies, which was web designing at the time, and now, of course, I love anything to do with space and space exploration, and I thought I could meld the two, and hence, I've been writing for the Universe Today, which was a fantastic opportunity. And then from there, I've just decided to run my own website as well, astroengine.com, and just put some of the more extreme personal views that I have on the universe. And it's quite interesting. I really enjoy what I'm doing. So,
well, I tell
I can
you,
think of worse jobs.
I certainly enjoy going through and looking at your updated information and where you're going and what your next adventure is, what your next writing is. That young lady that I've seen on your arm in several photos, she must have the patience of a saint with you.
No, she's extremely supportive of all that I do. And being a space writer isn't exactly, although it's great fun, you certainly don't do it for the money. And so, you know, it's great to have that kind of support, you know, to look after me and you know, keep me motivated to keep on writing, because it's it can be a hard slog at times. And of course, I spend a lot of time in the UK as well, so she has to be very patient with me spending time with the family as well. But now, hopefully, I'm going to have more of a permanent situation over in the States. So, yeah, no, it's working out very well. And yeah, she is very patient. But we're a great team.
Well, you know, they say behind every good man is a good woman, and so there you go.
Very patient woman, yeah.
Well, she has to be. She's married to a Brit. So, but in your list of accolades, one of your specialties is space weather systems.
Yeah.
Now, my question is this: as a dumb person just getting into space and starting to understand what's shaking out there, if space is a void, if it's a vacuum, then what is a weather system?
Well, the sun drives everything in our solar system, as we know. It warms our planet to a comfortable temperature. It influences all the other planets in the solar system. It drives our weather systems here on Earth. But also the sun has its own weather, and it goes through cycles of extreme violence to periods of extreme calm. I mean, at the moment, if you have a look at the sun, if you have a look on www.spaceweather.com, and in fact, I wanted to talk about this later, was that if you got a picture of the sun, and it's referred to as a blank sun. So that means there's no sunspots at the moment, not certainly on the facing side of the sun. And that is a great interest to me, because at the moment we've started solar cycle 24. We should be seeing a lot of sunspots. And basically sunspots come from the magnetic field lines that poke out from the surface of the sun. So as the solar cycle, which occurs every 11, kind of winds up over 11 years, it's basically these magnetic flux tubes, which you can refer to as long bands of elastic that stretch around the solar body. And because the sun rotates faster at its equator, it basically pulls this elastic around and around and around. And over the course of 11 years, and it's 11 years, that's fairly standard, give or take a year or two, but generally it's an average of 11 years, it will basically snap back into position, and it will flip the magnetic poles of the sun. And during just before that time, when it's at most stretched state, you get a lot of solar activity. So you get lots of solar flares. You get all these bubbles of superheated gas firing out into space.
And this isn't happening, or it's preparing to happen?
Well, there's several theories, and this kind of tied in again with my doomsday scenarios, because one of the scenarios is in 2012 we're going to get swallowed by a huge solar flare. And although, you know, huge solar flares are a possibility, it's certainly not going to cause any death and devastation, not to any huge degree on Earth, certainly not a doomsday event. And so I was kind of researching that, but of course, at the moment, we're going through an extremely calm period, because the solar cycle was supposed to have started last year. And during this wind-up period, we're supposed to be seeing quite a lot more coronal loops. The coronal loops are the flux, the magnetic field lines that are poking out from the surface of the sun. And at the bottoms of these coronal loops, there should be sunspots. And if you can see sunspots, it's a good gauge on how active the sun is. And looking at the sun at the moment, there's no sunspots. So we just don't know. There's a lot of mysteries with the sun. Although it's our nearest star, we still don't understand what drives a lot of the mechanisms that we observe. And we are pretty much at the mercy of its tantrums, if you like. Because I can guarantee in about 4 or 5, perhaps even 6 years, we will get, you know, more of an active period. Unless something strange happens with the sun, where this winding doesn't happen and this stressing of the magnetic field lines doesn't happen. And according to historical records, this has happened in the past. I'm not totally clear on dates, but there was a period of time called the Maunder Minimum where the solar activity was very, very low, and that was attributed to quite a lot of the cold weather or the mini ice age that we have here on Earth. And so there is this relationship between the sun and the Earth that we're only really beginning to understand. And space weather itself is basically the stuff that the sun produces, like the solar wind, these coronal mass ejections, these big bubbles of gas that can fire in our direction, and flares. We need to find ways of forecasting this, because as we're pushing more and more into space, it's getting quite dangerous out there. Yeah, if we send humans into space, there's a higher risk of cancer because of the massive radiation coming out from the sun during these solar maximum periods. And also, you know, we've got loads of satellites out there. We need to protect them. So we need to start predicting how violent the sun is going to be in the future.
So what kind of hurdles would we have to overcome? The difficulties that would be for a manned mission to Mars. What would we be facing from here to there?
Yeah, well, if we did a manned mission to Mars, and that would take realistically between 8 and 10 months to travel there, assuming when the Earth is at close approach with Mars, which happens at certain periods. So we'd choose that very wisely, but we'd also have to choose. We'd have to pick a period of time when the sun is at its least active, and that happens at solar minimum. So realistically, you're thinking, okay, this is probably a good time to send up a manned mission, because the sun at the moment isn't doing an awful lot. The interplanetary space is fairly calm. I mean, there are hazards out there, but we want to minimize these hazards, and this will be the best time to do it, to send a manned mission into space during this period of solar calm. Because even during solar calm, we've had some incidents with satellites. So it was the Mars Odyssey mission, I believe, that's orbiting Mars at the moment. And actually, during the critical time when Phoenix was touching down a few weeks ago, it was actually knocked out by an energetic solar particle. And basically, it was just a particle from the sun, highly energetic, when it hits one kind of some of its circuitry and overloaded its circuitry, so it kicked it into a safe mode. And of course, that wasn't very helpful, because we needed that satellite to look after Phoenix. Fortunately, we have two other missions. We have the European Mars Express, and we also have the NASA's Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter that was able to take those fantastic photographs. So it wasn't needed, but it would have been nice to have it actually online. But unfortunately, I went to a safe mode. I believe it's okay now. I would like to. I haven't actually done any research as to what that problem actually was, but if that was attributed to a solar particle. So even during solar minimum, the sun can throw a curveball at us. I mean, there's just no way of knowing. We just need to minimize those risks, and we need to improve our forecasting technology. And that would be critical for any Mars mission.
Right. As you're probably aware, the University of Calgary here in Alberta have just started a project, just got funded through the Canadian government, to do exactly that, is to understand more of what's happening out there, and to be able to reach out further than we've been able to reach out before to understand what our surroundings are. Because we're almost walking into the blindness of space. We really, as you mentioned, we really don't have a good grasp on it yet.
No, we don't. And although our knowledge of the sun is vastly better than it was only 10 years ago, because we've got such amazing missions out there at the moment, high-resolution images of the sun, so we're able to link solar mechanisms, the stuff that's going on the surface, with what's happening over out here on Earth. And we're able to link that to such a high degree now that we are getting there. And in another 10 years' time, I believe our forecasting technology will have been revolutionized. We've got lots of stuff going on. I think it's fantastic.
Yeah, Calgary are working on forecasting very devastating weather patterns, and commencing with the weather patterns of space and how it affects the patterns on Earth. And digging around this week, because Chris Holly from Endless Journeys blog has got me on this this march to find information. And I got to tell you that I listened to a wave file of what the Earth sounds like, and it's pretty ominous. You know, you would think we would be this harmonious hum that they used to talk about, but we're actually a very screechy, scratchy, scary type of place. And if I was an alien flying around and I tuned into Earth, I think I'd be avoiding it like the plague.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff going on, especially between the sun's, the solar wind and our upper atmosphere. And especially the sound you get if you listen to the hiss of the Van Allen belts, which are the highly radioactive bubbles that surround Earth. That's really the first barrier any mission's got to go through, and all the satellites, they are at risk in this Van Allen belt, because there's highly energetic particles and quite a huge high density of them being trapped in our magnetic field lines. And it does make a hell of a noise, and I did hear some of that. And also there was another article written about the sound of the sun, the sound of a coronal mass ejection as it's ejected from the sun. Of course, it produces radio waves. And so, of course, that can be received by us. And I listened to it, and it was quite amazing. It sounded almost like a day at the beach. It was like this wave, this whoosh of noise as this huge structure was ejected from the sun. It's certainly not quiet in space.
Yeah. What would be the scientific advantage of setting out for Mars? Would there be... What would come of the mission to Mars, do you think, Ian?
Well, this is a big debate, and everybody's saying that, you know, whatever a human can do, I'm surely a robot can do just as well. It doesn't matter, you know, when you save 99% of the cost to send a man to Mars and just invest it into small missions like Phoenix. I mean, right. Phoenix is a success story in itself, and that is just proof that these robots can do incredible science. But that's not really what human beings are all about. We go, we explore, we actually have to experience stuff to actually, it's just the way we are. It's as if, you know, if the original pioneers from Europe went over to the States, if they just sent a boat with a robot on just to see what was out there. That's a poor excuse to, you know, send humans out there. And it's the same thing for Mars and the Moon. And also, from a financial point of view, the Moon contains an awful lot of rich minerals and isotopes that we don't have here on Earth. And the Russian Space Agency, a while ago, they announced plans to actually send mining missions out to the moon and perhaps other planets. I mean, these were robotic missions, but they actually saw the advantages to gathering all these raw minerals to bring back to Earth, because that's a powerful commodity. If we can send manned missions to these planets, we'll be able to set up a base, and we'll be able to have an outpost doing all this valuable science, getting the human experience of exploring. That's just a natural desire in the human psyche anyway. But also the science can be far more detailed. Whatever Phoenix can do now in the course of 3 months, a human can do in an afternoon on the surface of Mars. So we've got a lot more scope to do an awful lot more detailed scientific analysis on Mars, and also just expand the influence of mankind throughout the solar system. At the end of the day, we're kind of on borrowed time with Earth. And if all the predictions are true, in 100 years' time, we'll be living on a very, very aggressive planet. So say if mankind, we are on a suicidal path to nothingness. Say if in the 200 years we're not here, wouldn't it be nice to know that some of our descendants are actually colonizing other planets and making it home? And perhaps from there we can start thinking about interstellar travel. I mean, that's quite science fiction-y at the moment, but it's all possible. We need to start thinking about the far future now.
Absolutely. The need to feed, as they say. It seems to be in our genetic code. Ian, we're at 22 before the hour. I can't believe the time's going as fast. I missed a couple of breaks. So we're going to catch up to him right now. Just bear with us, ladies and gentlemen.
All information provided in my TerraChat radio program is the opinion of the speaker and not necessarily the opinion of the owner or its agency. Although TerraChat takes all precautions to provide quality information, TerraChat assumes no responsibility or liability for the legitimacy of information provided by guest opinions or statements. You're in the Night Zone with the Colin Knight.
And you are in the Night Zone with Colin Knight. Tonight we have with us Dr. Ian O'Neill. As you probably noticed, we are minimizing as much as possible our promo contacts so that we can get to an absolute maximum of information with Ian. So, ladies and gentlemen, just bear with us.
We all have busy lives, and as such, we can't always be at a computer at a set time and date to listen to our favorite Blog Talk Radio show. So Blog Talk Radio has developed a method where you can listen to your favorite show right from your armchair or your desk. You could even listen archive or live. So how do you do it? Well, it's pretty easy. Come to www.blogtalkradio.com. Choose your favorite show. Hopefully it's TerraChat. Enter the specific station page and sign up for RSS feed, or add the various players to your website or blog, or put the player right on your desktop. It's as easy as that. Once you have the player, your favorite show is just a click away. Enjoy.
You're in the Night Zone with the Calling Knights.
Oh, indeed, the final frontier. Ian, I'm curious about space travel in general and the barriers of getting to Mars. You mentioned getting through the Van Allen belt. How did they do that right now? How did they get through there without totally incinerating the occupants?
Well, yeah, there are risks associated with that. I mean, a lot of the particles can be blocked by a very, very thin membrane of some lightweight metal. You know, aluminium can sometimes do the trick. But it's all about minimizing launch costs. So if you sent, say, a a satellite up into the Van Allen belt with an inch thick piece of lead just to stop every eventuality from happening. Yeah, it'll stop all the particles, but it would cost a fortune to send into space. Same thing is with manned missions. You've just got to balance up the risk with how much it's going to cost to send something heavy up there. And so far, the technology is good so far. We're able to send man into space. They're able to protect them sufficiently against these high-energy particles. Of course, astronauts do receive a massive dose of radiation, so I dare say they do have an increased risk of complications like cancer and all sorts of other nasty medical conditions. But the risks are seen as low enough to send man into space. I mean, the Van Allen belt is one issue, and it's more of an issue for like the satellites that orbit inside that zone. There's more of a risk that they can be overloaded and they can slip into a safe mode, or they can even just flip upside down. I mean, there's even the risk, it's not so much the radiation risk, but if the sun is highly active, it can basically heat up the atmosphere. So when you heat something up, the atmosphere can expand only by a small amount, but the influence of the atmosphere will become very, very critical to these orbiting satellites, because they'll get more drag and they'll start to drop in altitude, making re-enter the atmosphere. So that's another risk to these satellites. But for humans, I mean, space in general is a very, very aggressive place on the human body. And generally, most of the radiation is blocked by the shielding we've already got, by the International Space Station. The astronauts up there are protected because there is a huge protection from the Earth's magnetic field. The influence of the Earth's magnetic field encompasses most of human activity in space, especially as high as the International Space Station's orbit, plus the satellites are orbiting inside there. So you are kind of protected, again, from the worst that the sun can throw at us. But there's not really much protection from cosmic rays, which are high-energy particles from outside the solar system that come in and fire at great speeds, and they can cause damage to human tissue. But as soon as you leave the protective shield of Earth, and even as far as the moon, you will receive an awful lot more radiation than you would do normally. And, of course, you've got to think, on the surface of the moon and the surface of Mars, they don't have their own magnetic fields. So it's not like having a day out on the surface of the Earth when you're out on Mars. You're open to pretty much most of what the sun can throw at you. So there needs to be some early warning devices put into place. There needs to be a more effective forecasting to protect against these problems. But also you need radiation shielding. There's no two ways about it. You're going to have to, I mean, a lot of people believe we should go underground just to protect ourselves from the ravages of space.
So we would need to develop some kind of a solar defense system if we were to colonize Mars.
Yeah, well, we do kind of have we already have an early warning system set up for Earth. We've got the Solar and Heliospheric Observatory, which is based between the Earth and the Sun. It's basically sitting in this island of stability called the Lagrangian point. And it's at the point where the gravitational pull of the Earth and the gravitational pull of the Sun evens out. So you basically got this island stability. So that's a good place to put some early warning systems. It's a good place to put an observatory because it's a very stable position for them to, like SOHO, the Solar and Heliospheric Observatory, it's a good place for it to constantly view the sun. And that's been a groundbreaking mission. And of course, by it sitting there, whatever the sun throws at SOHO, it's going to hit us. So if it's got to come through the Lagrangian point, it's going to hit us at a certain time after it's hit those satellites in that position. So SOHO actually acts as an early warning system already. So the particles that are thrown out from the sun, they hit SOHO, and then it sends a warning signal to us before the particles reach us, and then we're able to power down satellites. We're able to power down, say, even national grids here on the ground, because they may get overloaded by a huge input of solar energetic particles. And I've actually written an article. I thought, well, if this can be done on fairly inexpensively, really, for a space mission, just send up one instrument between Mars and the Sun in the Mars Sun first Lagrangian point, So it's sitting there constantly eclipsing the sun from Mars. It's just a basic detector, particle detector. If it receives a lot of flux coming from the sun, it sends a signal down to the colonists on Mars, and they're able to get into shelter. That'd be a very basic early warning system, and fairly rudimentary, really. All it is just a particle detector just sitting in the vacuum of space between Mars and the sun, and as soon as it receives images and particles, it just sends that signal, and everybody gets in. So that's a possibility. It could be cloned from the efforts that we're having on with Earth, with the SOHO mission.
Well, yeah, and I can see exactly how that would develop from a very basic detector to something very lavish for a possible detection of movement out in space that could harm us. You know, we've talked a lot about meteorites and comets and planets moving around in the solar system that possibly could affect what we're doing. And there is some gravitational pulls out there that we have yet to completely understand what's happening. And it's almost impossible to discuss space recently without the shadow of Planet X permeating the conversation. Mm-hmm. You know, however, the next few months, I got to tell you, TerraChat, we're digging as far into this as we can with the theory of Nibiru and the Anunnaki and the similarities with the Christian teachings, you know, because they are quite striking. However, I got to tell you, Ian, you had cautioned me that I would find difficulty finding somebody to talk on this subject, and you're absolutely right. I find a lot of the good chatters, the intelligent people on the peripherals, but I cannot find somebody that's prepared to go on air and discuss Nibiru per se in its exact terms.
Yeah, it's a bit frustrating. I've had some limited efforts to contact these people, but I just don't think they want to be contacted. I mean, a lot of them, I've noticed on their personal website, they're saying that they are currently in the process of writing their second, follow-up massive book to the Doomsday event in 2012, and they don't want to be disturbed. I come from more of a school of thought that you need to argue your arguments a bit better. You need to have this debate. And I'd love to just speak to one of these guys, because there is some fundamental flaws with the reasoning behind Planet X. I mean, I'm not saying that the prophecies are wrong. I'm not saying that the religious belief or the spiritual belief that something big is going to happen in 2012 is wrong. I'm not saying any of that. I've got a big problem with the guys who are using astronomical evidence to try and prove their own incorrect theory on Planet X, and that's basically what's been going on. And at the end of every one of those trails, you've got a book that's wanting to be sold, and I find that very distasteful, and I would just like to have some sort of open debate with a Planet X believer or a publisher. I mean, there's a lot of believers that believe in Planet X, and that's fine, that's their views. I don't believe in Planet X being the same as Nibiru, and there's a lot of inaccuracies in the scientific thinking if they start trying to prove this thinking, because it just isn't out there. And there's a lot of very intelligent people out there that are just thrown it by the wayside and thought there's no point in arguing this, because at the end of the day it's a load of bunkum. What's the point in arguing something that doesn't exist anyway? You know, it's obvious. But if you have a look at some of these videos, and if you have a look at some of this writing, it's extremely convincing. And I find myself, I was watching, it was even a mainstream American documentary, I think it was on the Discovery Channel, talking about Mayan prophecy in Planet X. And I was totally convinced, but it wasn't really based on any proper scientific foundry. I mean, in that case, that was more of the prophecies, the Nostradamus and the Mayan prophecies, which is all fine. And so that's kind of open to interpretation. But it really does get me angry when I see people quoting scientific literature and publications when they haven't really done their homework. The facts just do not connect. And that's what I talked about in a few of my articles. And as you can tell, I've done quite a few on that. So I obviously believe it's worth arguing. But it would be nice to get these people into the open and just discuss it.
Yep, I do. I got to tell you, I do enjoy your articles. And am I a believer of Planet X? Something's going to happen. I agree with you. 2012 is going to be a changing time in our society, in our method of doing things. What that changing time will be, I'm not quite sure. But what does fascinate me is how does a man like Nostradamus figure on what's going to happen in 2012, and how do the Mayans do it and be so darn accurate? We're at 9 minutes to the hour, Ian. Just one deep breath, 20-second break.
You're in the night zone with the Calling Knights.
And we have with us tonight, as we head into the final 8 minutes, Dr. Ian O'Neill. He was with us on the 2012 show, and he's been gracious enough to come back and finish the conversation that we'd started several months ago. Ian, it's really good to have you here. I'm glad you're in California, although... you know, it's been known to shake, rattle, and roll about this time of year, so just keep your head down over there, you know.
Certainly will be.
There's a lot of movement of volcanic activity around the world, and obviously the climate changes, and we're seeing a lot more media attention on the Arctic pack and what have you. Has any of this, is there any evidence out in this solar weather, in this space, that would connect to what is happening on Earth?
The connection between solar activity and Earth, I think I'd be naive if I said that there's no connection, because of course, you know, the Earth has developed in this, in the environment of the sun's influence ever since it was formed. I'm sure there is some sort of influence, but there's absolutely no reason to believe that the solar activity is connected with geological activity or, I mean, there's obviously input into the weather system, so there could be some sort of reaction by the atmosphere to an increase in solar output. But to be honest, the greatest pressure that we're feeling at the moment is from global warming, and that is certainly man-made. I've done several articles on global warming, and many people believe that that is a global conspiracy in itself. That's just incorrect, because there is strong scientific evidence to suggest that we are harming the planet. I mean, that's pretty obvious to me. But as for the sun influencing our weather systems, that's bound to play a part. I mean, the only energy input we've got is from the sun. But the solar variability isn't that huge to cause, you know, global warming patterns. Right. There is a longer term effect. I mean, if you look back at the Maunder minimum period a few hundred years ago, there was a minimum in solar activity, and that coincided with the small ice age, the little ice age in the northern hemisphere. Whether that's connected, possibly, but I believe that's a longer scale, longer time scale kind of thing. That happened over tens to 100 years, whereas what we're experiencing at the moment is happening over time scales of 10 and less years, and we're on many different tipping points in the climate at the moment. That is down to the amount of carbon we're pumping out. But as for geological activity, all these earthquakes we've been having, we know for a fact that a lot of earthquakes happen in swarms. And this has a chain effect around the world, where it can destabilize regions of where there's tectonic plates, edges of tectonic plates. So perhaps that could be causing it. But apparently, this isn't. Although there have been some great, there's been some huge documented earthquakes recently. apparently this isn't above the norm. I mean, there may have been one or two anomalous large earthquakes, but according to the experts, they believe that there's no real difference in the frequency of earthquakes. But of course, that's open to interpretation. I think that's something we'll probably find out in a few years' time when we look back on the data. But for now, I don't think there's much of a connection. Nothing that extreme, anyway.
Yeah, because people do like to obviously make it somebody else's fault. They're always looking for that divine person that has cracked the whip and caused the wrath. Never, I've noticed as human beings, we tend to slough off the reliability or the ability of mankind to affect Earth. My thoughts on global warming is twofold. I believe Mother Earth will correct herself, and if that means she is going to shake man off the earth like a flea from a dog, then I think she will.
Yeah. I think you're right, and there's a lot of evidence to suggest that, because the Earth has recovered from huge volcanic eruptions that pumps huge amounts of carbon dioxide and ash into the air. And there is a period of recovery, and the Earth can do that, especially with the plants and creatures on Earth. There is a balance, and that kind of brings into the whole Gaia theory of Earth, that the Earth is a self-sustaining mechanism almost. That, you know, if something's put out of whack, something else compensates. And I believe there's a lot of truth in that kind of theory. So I believe if humans cease to exist today, in 100 or 1,000 years, the Earth would recover. I believe that would be the case.
Yeah, I think so too. So what's on your agenda with 2 minutes remaining, Ian? What's on your agenda for the upcoming month or so?
Well, more article writing, and I'm hoping to do some more 2012 articles because they've proven very popular. And I'm actually in the draft phase of getting the geomagnetic shift article done, because I've been getting so many messages about the geomagnetic shift possibility with Earth, the polar shift as well. And I think that pretty much wraps up the main articles for 2012. From there, I'd like to look into some more. There is actually an article in the pipeline where I'd like to investigate when the Galileo mission entered the atmosphere of Jupiter, because of course it was carrying quite a lot of plutonium on board, I believe, to fuel the satellite. And there's a lot of conspiracy theories to suggest that when it entered the atmosphere of Jupiter, it got crushed and created a nuclear explosion inside the atmosphere of Jupiter. And so we got all these theories now that perhaps underneath fairly calm exterior, although there's a few anomalies on the surface of Jupiter, but perhaps there is some sort of chain reaction going on. There's some evidence for that, but I think
impressive.
I think the science is a little bit flawed behind that, but I want to investigate it. And also, there's plans to drop the Cassini mission into the atmosphere of Saturn, and of course that's carrying nuclear material as well. So there's quite a lot of exciting stuff on the horizon as far as space missions are concerned. But also with that, you get a lot of conspiracy theories, you get a lot of mistruths. And I just want to just follow them up and try and answer a lot of the questions as scientifically as I possibly can.
Well, I appreciate it, and we're running up to 48 seconds left on the clock. Ian, once again, it's been an absolute pleasure. I'm going to call on you again in about a month's time, sir, and we'll get an update as to where you are. 30
Fantastic.
Seconds.
I'll be here.
Thank you very much, Ian. You take care of yourself, and my regards to your wife, and you take care, sir.
Thank you, Colin. You take care of yourself. Catch you soon.
And ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Ian O'Neill from AstroEngine.com. Well, that's it. That's all. Another edition of TerraChat Thinking Outside of the Box. It's been an absolute pleasure one more time. What a fantastic night we have in here all of the time. Looking forward to catching your information. Remember, send me emails. Let me know how you're doing. Up. And you see, they have to tell me it's over. That's it. That's all. God bless.
You're in the night zone with the Calling Knights.